The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. If you follow USA Today's bestseller list or the New York Times, you might notice that this week the number one selling novel is by a guy named Greg Iles. It's the third and final book in his trilogy, the Natchez Burning Trilogy. The final book, Mississippi Blood, just came out, went straight to number one. This is an amazing trilogy, over 2,300 pages between the three books, and we'll be talking to Greg Iles about it coming up following NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Greg Iles. Hello, Greg.
Hi, Vic. Glad to be here.
Greg, am I hearing a little Mississippi in your voice?
You're hearing a lot of Mississippi, Vic. yeah, I'm not ashamed of that.
Okay. Well, tomorrow's a big day as we're recording this. A book that a lot of people have been waiting for is being officially published, and it's a book called Mississippi Blood. It's the final book in your trilogy. And, you know, I'm going to have a hard time doing this interview, Greg, because I don't know where to start. I mean, this is spoiler city. We need to talk about the first book and the second book and the third book and the other books. And you know, this is spoiler city. Where do we start?
You know, the way for people to think about this is at its core, even though it's epic in scale and it really has to do with race and family and America and the South, what it's really about is a son discovering that the father who raised him, who was a beloved figure in the community, a physician, may not be the man that he and everyone else thought he was, and that he may have committed a serious crime, a murder to cover up a sin from his past. And that may sound a little bit gothic, and maybe it is, but at its core, that's what the story is.
And this story begins in that first book in this trilogy, Natchez Burning. Tell us about this city. This is your town, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not the oldest city, but it's the oldest continuous settlement on the Mississippi River. And around 1850, it was the richest small city in the entire country. It had more millionaires than any city in America except New York and Philadelphia. It was the capital of the Cotton Empire of the South. It was one of the capitals of slavery. The second biggest slave market in the country was in Natchez. It's a town of contradictions. In some ways, it was much more liberal and advanced than the rest of Mississippi. It surrendered very early in the Civil War, so it was never destroyed. Even today, it's filled with antebellum mansions, perfectly preserved. But it's 50% black, 50% white, so it's really a sort of a crucible for the issues that really are so important today in America.
There was some wheeling and dealing at the end of the Civil War to make sure those beautiful buildings didn't get ruined, huh?
There's been wheeling and dealing in Natchez from the beginning, but, you know, I could say that's true of every town from New Jersey to Los Angeles.
My guest is Greg Iles. His book, Mississippi Blood, just coming out, and he's getting ready to go on a mammoth book tour, and he's going to be coming through our area, and I'll give you that info here during the interview. Greg, Natchez is up on the high ground. I've never been down there, but just from reading your book, I've got a sense of the topography. It's up on the highland, and then across the river you've got Louisiana and a very different kind of community.
Oh, man. You know, the way it is now, you know, and even in 1850, in the days of yellow fever and malaria and stuff, you had what they call the nabobs of Natchez, the true rich cotton barons living up 250 feet above the river. And, of course, then you had Natchez under the hill, which is where they sold slaves and had bars and houses of prostitution. And that's still there. But across the river, you had the flat land of Louisiana, where a lot of the cotton was really grown. And even today, you know, right across the river, 12 miles across, Faraday, Louisiana, home of Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Lee Lewis, first cousins. And that gives you an idea of the feeling. And, you know, back in 27, man, the river stretched 60 miles from Natchez to Monroe, Louisiana. So this is land that's been through some real trauma over the years.
That was a big flood. Did the houses on the hill sit there just kind of looking down at it?
Oh, absolutely. Sure, uh-huh. Sure. Uh-huh. On the Louisiana side and even on the Mississippi side north of us, they basically had the sharecroppers, the black sharecroppers, living in tents on the levee month after month after month, while down at Natchez in the hotels and, you know, the people with money were just fine.
My guest is Greg Iles. Greg, I've got a confession. I've just read this trilogy. I haven't read your previous books. Now, I understand you introduced your protagonist in some other books. Tell us about him.
Well, Penn Cage is a bit of a Grisham-esque character to start out. He's sort of a Boy Scout. He's a former prosecutor from Texas who turned his hand to writing legal thrillers, and his life was going pretty well till his wife got cancer and died. And he returned to his hometown and got caught up, became mayor of the town. And in the course of doing that, he began to take on, I would say, the negative parts of society or flat-out evil on a more direct basis. And, you know, he's, over the years, over the books, he's compromised with his ideals, and he's had to, you know, when we fight evil, as they say, we sometimes have to take on the tactics of our adversaries, and that can help you win, but it can also, you pay a moral price for that and a price in your soul. So that's the territory these books are in. That I want people to know, how many books do you start, and it's the same old formulaic thing, a new version of the last book? These books are not that. None of the Penn Cage books. These hit you where you live, and I think people know that a few pages in. So I hope they give them a chance, because you know how it is. It's hard to find good books these days.
Well, fortunately, your book's coming out, this third book. And as I was reading them, I thought to myself, you know, a lot of these books in series or in trilogies or in whatever configuration, you can read them out of order, you can read them as standalones, but I think with this series, I don't know what you're going to say, but I think you need to start with Natchez Burning. I think you need to read them in order. What do you think?
I think you're right. I took great care, though, that people could come. They can even come to the third one without reading the first ones if that's what they want to do. I certainly I took special time in those first two chapters to make sure nobody would be completely lost or unmoored. But ideally, sure, I would say get the whole trilogy. And now, thank goodness, the publishers put out sort of the first two volumes on ebook, so you can get those pretty easily if you want to.
And once you get going on that first book, you'll get hooked, and you'll have 2,000 pages to go. Wow, what?
And that sounds crazy, doesn't it? People think of something like that. They put off starting it thinking, oh, I can't read that. But the thing is, you know what? My rule is this. If a book is bad, it can't be short enough. And if a book is good, it can't be long enough. Think of Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. Mm-hmm. I wish that book would have never ended.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Greg Iles. Greg, his father, Penn's father, is Dr. Tom Cage, and much loved in his community, and as we discover, a very conflicted character, very mysterious character. Now, I understand that your dad was also a doctor, and I know that Penn Cage isn't you, but there are some autobiographical elements in here, and I like to point to one in the first book, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say at one point Penn sees a photo, and he recognizes himself as a little boy, and he's at a Ku Klux Klan rally, and it's a huge rally, and this really happened, didn't it?
Yeah, that rally, that's the biggest KKK rally in the history of the United States, and it happened 1 mile from the little suburban house I grew up in. And my dad took me down there, not as a participant, but my dad was really educated. He was a reader, and he was a doctor, and he had served in Germany. So he knew what fascism was like, and he did not like that. And he took me far enough down there to see the spectacle, and he took pictures of it. And what I saw is just indelible in my mind. Not only the guys, the men and the women with robes and some children, but even the horses had these red robes on and white Klan robes. It was one of the scariest things you can imagine.
And this must have been in what, the mid-60s?
That was 65. Yeah, at a place called Liberty Park, a place where I ended up practicing football as a 12-year-old and playing baseball. And yeah, it's you know, that's the thing. These things are interwoven in the fabric of the town, and it's misleading. You know, the thing, when you write about something like this, it sort of fulfills a northern fantasy that race is a southern problem. And if the events of the last 3 years or so have proved anything, it's that race is an American problem. You know, these police shootings and the riots and these problems, they're not happening in Selma, Alabama, or Natchez, Mississippi. They're happening in very different places geographically. The thing about race in the South is, racism was always in the open in the South. It's covert in the North and in the West.
In case you're just tuning in, Greg Iles is my guest, and we're talking about his trilogy of books, beginning with Natchez Burning. The second book is called The Bone Tree, and just coming out, the final book in this trilogy, Mississippi Blood. And he joins us by telephone from Mississippi. And as the first book opens, that terrible thing has just happened. Three civil rights workers have been found in an earthen dam. It became a notorious incident, and people were not prosecuted for this for many years. And their names, Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, live on. Mickey Schwerner's brother was a professor here at Antioch College, our licensee. And
really?
Yep.
Really?
And he did a jazz show on this radio station for many years. And that bit of history, it starts the book and we get the vibe right away.
Oh, but, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, Vic, the contradictions are there right even in that, because the reason that's remembered nationally and is so well known is because of the two white kids who were lost, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If that had been three black kids, as happened to untold numbers of black kids down south, it would have been forgotten like all the other crimes, you know? So there is complexity and lessons to be learned about ourselves in all these crimes.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO. Giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Greg Iles joins us, and it's the Book Nook. We'll be right back after this message. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Greg Iles. He's getting ready to go out on a mammoth book tour for the third book in his trilogy. It's called Mississippi Blood, and we've been talking about these books as much as we can. The second book is called The Bone Tree. Was there really a bone tree?
That's a good question. Now, the tree, as I describe it, really exists very close to the area I described it, and it's a terrifying thing to see. It's a cypress tree out in the swamp with an opening, sort of a cave in the middle, just about big enough to pull a Volkswagen into. Now, the actual thing I based the bone tree in the book on wasn't actually a tree. It was a house. There was known to be a torture house, a Klan torture house, in the area right around our part of Mississippi and Louisiana. And the FBI was never able to find this, but they had numerous informant reports about the things that happened there. And there was torture equipment there, and not everybody hurt there was black. So, you know, there were frequently pastors in the KKK claverns, and they would enforce their own brand of justice on people who committed adultery or sold liquor to underage kids. But, of course, mostly it was civil rights-type crimes. And I wanted something more primitive and atavistic than a house. And I knew about the tree, and so from that was some artistic license, and that's a sort of inside view of what we writers do.
Greg, when I was looking into this series and you, I discovered that from what I'm hearing, this Natchez Burning was going to be a standalone book, and then when you got going on the project, something really changed it, and this was a life-changing event for you, wasn't it? You nearly died.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was near my deadline, and I was trying to write it as a conventional thriller, albeit a long one. And I pulled out onto Highway 61, which everybody knows from the Dylan song, of course, and a pickup truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour. Broke many, many bones, like my bandmate Stephen King in his accident, but also it tore my aorta, which about 1% of people, I think, survived that. And I woke up out of a coma a week later. And I just, at that point, my entire perspective had changed. You know, I thought, I'm writing about the South, I'm writing about race, I'm writing about family. I'm not going to pull any punches, and I'm not going to worry about the commercial demands. And so suddenly the book expanded to, I realized it was going to take three epic novels to deal with it. And in the course of that, I had to change agents. I lost my publisher. It was really a challenging road for me with a lot of uncertainty. But ultimately, when Natchez Burning came out 5 years later, my previous book had been number one. Then 5 years passed, and nobody knew if this thing would sell at all. So it's really been sort of a miracle for me.
I guess we need to talk about the Double Eagles. Tell us about them. Are they a real group? Did they really exist?
Well, the real group is called the Silver Dollar Group. And my character, Henry Sexton, the heroic reporter, is based on a guy named Stanley Nelson, who I've come to know really well, a reporter at a tiny little newspaper across the river from me, 5,000 subscribers. And he was only beat out for the Pulitzer Prize by the Spotlight team on the church story. And Stanley, I don't want to say too much, but thankfully this is a guy who's worked in obscurity for little to no money his whole life, and he outdid the FBI on these real-life civil rights cold cases. And finally, Hollywood is coming knocking, wanting to make a movie about Stanley. So that's a great thing. Now, the group themselves, the Silver Dollar Group, who I call the Double Eagles, were a group of disillusioned Klan guys who knew the KKK had been penetrated by the FBI. They stopped going to meetings. They pretended they weren't in the Klan. The only badge of membership they carried was a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth. And these were some psychotic, racist guys that did a lot of damage. They killed a lot of people. You don't even want to talk about what their crimes were. And that's the only thing that led me to write about the KKK. You know, as a thriller writer from the South, I had never written about the KKK because it falls into that sort of northern dark stereotype of what the South is. And if you know much about the Klan, you know that they were compromised pretty early on by the FBI. Some of the heads of the Klan were paid informants by the Bureau. But these Double Eagles are silver dollar guys. These were some bad guys, and none of them ever went to jail until really one just a few years ago. So this had to be addressed.
My guest is Greg Iles. We're talking about his books, and you can meet him. He is coming through our area, and we were recording this right before the book is coming out, and he will be coming through according to the calendar and the time that we're airing this interview. He will be at Books and Company on Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m., and he'll actually be in Cincinnati the night before that if you can't make it to Dayton. He'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. Our signal reaches down there to Cincinnati for those of you listening down there. And wow, the second book, according to my research, you weren't planning to do anything about a JFK conspiracy, but something happened, huh?
Well, you know, when you start researching my area of the woods, and there are some ties between those Klan elements and the effort to retake Cuba and Carlos Marcello, the mafioso. Once I started going down those roads, that led me pretty quickly to the JFK situation, and so that became maybe not a central element of the Bone Tree, but certainly a rabbit trail, let's say. And I enjoyed doing that research.
in that first book, Natchez Burning, as we get to meet the Double Eagles and your intrepid small-town newspaper editor, can we say who he's interviewing? Is that too much to give away, who he's interviewing?
Wait a second. Okay, which book are we talking
in the
about?
First, in the first book.
He's interviewing a Double Eagle. We can say that, right?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I'm deferring to you as far as spoilers here.
Oh, no, that's not a spoiler. Sure, yeah. He's what you're getting is something. Well, you know, we recently just had this event where the woman in the Emmett Till case recanted and said she lied about whether the boy had made advances toward her, which resulted in his murder.
Right.
And very similar to that, the Henry Sexton character is interviewing a Double Eagle who has cancer and is near death. And what you see, you know, a lot of these guys were raised in religiously fundamentalist homes, and they really have a fear of punishment after death, burning in hell. And as death approaches, you get these come-to-Jesus moments where they want to confess all. Stanley, the real guy, has been in nursing homes before and actually heard some of these guys babbling about black boys standing in the corner of the room and things like that. It's really scary stuff.
Another element in this is the fact that these Double Eagles, at least the core original group, these guys were war veterans, and they'd been very desensitized to violence. They actually savored it, and this bled through literally into their activities after leaving the service.
Well, you know, there's a contradiction. When we think of wartime heroes, we automatically put our John Wayne glasses on and we just see them as 100% Boy Scouts grown up to being Sergeant Rock. But anybody from the military can tell you, a guy can be heroic under combat conditions and God forbid, can be convicted for child molestation 5 years later when he gets home. I mean, human beings are human beings, and they are complex. Mm. And nobody is true blue through and through, and nobody is truly evil through and through. But men like that who are very accustomed to violence, for them, violence is just a, you know, it's like saying war is an extension of politics by other means. On a personal level, for men who were very accustomed to killing, once they found themselves in what they saw as a race war or a war for the preservation of the white race, it was only natural for them to use violence. That was the tool they knew. They didn't have any qualms about it. It's similar to when you start looking at the JFK assassination. People tend to look at that as this big mythic thing they studied about in school, the assassination of the president. When in fact, if you look at it as a simple murder, cui bono, who stood to benefit, who would be willing to cross a line like that? For men accustomed to violence, whether it's Cuban revolutionaries or mafioso who took out hits every couple of weeks, violence was not a big deal. And killing a president was not necessarily a big deal.
Or shooting a reverend in Mississippi or whatever.
Sure.
Not
I mean,
Mississippi,
to them,
in Memphis.
It's almost a measure of manhood to do something like that.
I guess I meant to say Memphis.
Yeah,
shooting a reverend. I'm sure they shot some reverends in Mississippi, too. But
Well, sadly, some reverends were on the side of the shooters in Mississippi. But, you know, again, all human beings are complex.
My guest is Greg Iles. For your newspaper editor, it's personal. And he's into music. He's a musician. And he had a father figure that was very dear to him. And so this is personal. And you're a musician, right? Isn't that your background as a musician?
Oh, yeah. And that, I got to say, you were right to home in on that. A lot of that character is based on my reporter friend, but that part of his soul, really, I got to put some of myself in there. And I think that's an important thing with the South, because whether you're talking about the white community or the black community in the South, music is just part of the fabric of life, whether it's Sunday dinner on the grounds at church or Wednesday church or out in the Delta or country honky-tonks, man, that's just life in the South. And so it really, it was good to be able to portray some of that.
And what kind of music did you do?
You know, I started out playing acoustic music, folk sort of music, but I, going through my iterations through life, I've played in everything from progressive country bands to blues rock to original to now, of course, I play with the Rock Bottom Remainders, a bunch of other writers for charity, and we play old rock and roll from the 50s and 60s. I'm one of the youngest ones, so it was a little change for me to learn all that early 60s rock, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, we've collected some of your other band members over the years on this program. We've had Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, James McBride, and we've actually had Kathy Kamen Goldmark right here in studio.
You've had most of them there.
And Kathy, bless her heart, she was a wonderful woman. She went to Antioch College, and we had her on for her books.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know she had that connection. Wow.
Yeah. And
well, you know, we were supposed to retire when Kathy passed away. I mean, we stuck to that for about a year and a half. But as Dave said, I guess we didn't retire because we've done a few shows. And just 2 days ago, really, before I left for this, some emails started passing around, and it looks like we may be playing Sun Valley, Idaho sometime around August. So we're not retired. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing for the public.
Is that
fun for us?
The writers' conference out there?
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh.
For us, you know, who cares? We don't care.
Yeah.
If it's a good enough charity event and it's enough to get us together and get us all there, we get to hang out together, and that's all that matters.
Well, knowing Kathy, she would not have wanted you to stop.
Man, you got that right.
Yeah.
She was straight up all about the music, man.
She was a force. Is Sam playing in the band too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. And Sam came down. I just got married. How long have we been married? 2.5 years. And Sam, a lot of the band came down for the wedding, but Sam actually played in the wedding along with some of the people singing. So Sam and I are good friends.
Mm. In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Greg Iles. His book, Mississippi Blood, just coming out. And, okay, we need to talk about Mississippi Blood a little bit. This is really a legal thriller compared to the other two, right?
I hate to say that because it kind of people will pigeonhole that in their mind, and it's not what they're thinking it is. But it's a legal thriller in the sense that Anatomy of a Murder from the 50s or Presumed Innocent was a legal thriller. I'll concede that.
Let's give them a little teaser on this one. We meet a character named Serenity Butler, another writer.
Yeah, another writer, but a little more than a writer. Serenity came to the thing very late, you know, and the reason is, I don't want to give a spoiler. You're right, we got to be careful.
Uh-huh.
Penn loses somebody very dear to him in the second book.
Yeah.
And, you know, Penn is not your traditional thriller hero. He's cerebral. He's more, in some ways, he's more of an observer, more than he's not a fake all physical action hero, and he sort of needs a partner, and Serenity came late. She is an African-American writer who's become famous for writing a memoir, but she's a military veteran, and I just was on a radio show here in Jackson, Mississippi, and the producer was an African-American woman who looked like a slight little thing, and the host told me she was an Army veteran. So I thought, you know what? Serenity's pretty close to some real-life figures, I found out.
I think
she sort of provides here's the irony. To come to a thriller like this, if you want to call it a thriller, and the physical stuff is not being done by the male hero, it's being done by the female writer. You know, I think that's part of the twist, and it's a lot of the fun of it,
mm-hmm.
even though it's a pretty heavy subject, but still, it has some fun and some humor in it.
Penn is not Jack Reacher.
No, he's not.
No.
He's not. And that's no knock against Jack Reacher, but these are different kind of books than that.
My guest is Greg Iles. And Greg, I think we need to talk about, is it Viola?
Viola, yeah.
Okay, I think we need to talk about her a little bit.
Viola is... Viola Turner is the African-American nurse of Dr. Tom Cage back in the 60s, and she is somebody who was certainly smart enough to have been a physician, but due to the exigencies of life, wound up being a nurse. and not even one with a nursing degree, but just trained in the hospital, as a lot of women were back in those days. In Natchez, they trained them in Charity Hospital, and they worked their whole lives, very dedicated. But through working in close proximity to Dr. Cage through stressful times, and after losing her husband in Vietnam War, as so many young African-American guys died over there, she ends up in an affair with Dr. Cage in the traumatic 60s, and a child results from that, unknown to the doctor. We're getting up close to spoiler territory. Mm-hmm. But because of that and because of the activism of her brother in the movement, she has to flee to Chicago, and she only lives because she promises never to return. And, of course, she does return after many years. She returns to die in her hometown, as a lot of people do. I'm finding in as I age, you know, a lot of African-Americans returning to Mississippi, white folks too. You know, they go off and make their living, and then they retire back home. And that's what kicks off the story, really. You know, was she... When she dies at the opening of the first book, was it a mercy killing? Did Tom Cage do her the favor of her life? Did he kill her to silence her? Or was she killed by the KKK, who threatened to kill her if she ever came back? And, boy, that's just the starting point. So I think people can tell how complex a story this is.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Greg Iles. We're talking about his latest book, Mississippi Blood, and the books that preceded it. And he's coming through our area on book tour. He'll be in Cincinnati Tuesday, April 11th at 7 o'clock in the evening at Joseph Beth Booksellers. And then he'll be in Dayton at Books & Company in Beaver Creek on Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m. The Book Nook will continue with Greg Iles right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have on the program today Greg Iles. Mississippi Blood has just come out. It's the third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy, and he's coming through our area to promote it and to talk about it. And, Greg, I love a good villain, and these Double Eagles, man, they are great villains. And
They're bad. They're bad guys. And the scary thing is how real it is. I said to a guy earlier today, you know, some people don't think about it. They just passively consume the entertainment. But, look, every great thriller, certainly, but even dramas, a work can only be as strong as its villain. You know, Star Wars isn't Star Wars because of Luke Skywalker. It's Star Wars because of Darth Vader, right?
Yeah.
And you got to have, for adults, you got to have villains of depth and menace that is credible and humanity that people recognize and think, I could have walked by that guy in Walmart 5 minutes ago. And that's the scariest thing to me about those guys. Because I walked by them in Walmart my whole life without ever even knowing the crimes they'd committed. And then once you realize what you're living among, it's a pretty scary thing.
It's that kind of community where you actually saw someone finally get arrested and you said to yourself, oh my, I know that guy.
Oh, yeah, the thing that's happened to me the most about this, and, of course, the reporter that Henry's based on has just put out a book from LSU Press called Devil's Walking. And the locals, really, for four or five parishes around and four or five counties around, the reaction we keep getting is, oh, my God, I grew up right next door to that guy, or he used to go hunting with my dad or whatever. I mean, you just, you know, you got to realize these crimes were kept secret sort of by the conspiracy of propriety in southern towns. You know, it just, they didn't write in the paper about these murders, or if they did, it was just a cursory mention. You know, if it was very high profile, they might mention there was a reward offered by a national union or something, but you didn't hear about this stuff. And these guys had real jobs. They were cops, or they worked at the paper mill or the tire plant. And, normal life went on, and yet once it was dark, once midnight passed, these guys were doing some seriously psychopathic stuff and hurting a lot of people.
Greg, you, over the course of 2,000 pages in these three books, have so many twists, and you keep so many storylines going, and I have a lot of favorite scenes. We become almost sympathetic with this Double Eagle who is essentially on his deathbed and wants to talk to the editor.
Yeah.
He wants to somehow get these crimes off of his conscience. And when you do his death scene, oh,
ooh.
I love that death scene. I think my favorite part, though, is when he starts talking about his credit card, but we won't. We won't talk about that.
Oh, my God. You know, to me, the coldest thing about that was the role the sister
His sister,
had in it,
yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
It just, when you think that something like that deep tribal racist feeling could even overpower ties of family, man, that's a pretty scary thing. Yeah. And you see it play out right in front of your eyes. It's disturbing.
Well, and even though he has been involved in all these evil acts, we feel sympathy for him.
You get the feeling he was the big kid, the fat kid, the slow kid, and that somehow these things he did, he was sort of bullied into it. And you know, what could he have done? Obviously, he could have gone to the police, but my God, the police were infiltrated with Klan too. But you got to ask yourself, it's a moral conundrum. You know, is the guy who takes part in the gang rape on the pool table because he's scared to his friends are going to make fun of him, is he less guilty than the other guys who committed the crime? I mean, this is, you know, difficult stuff.
Mm. Well, I love it that you write these massive books, and even though they're completely different in style and substance, you remind me a little bit of one of my favorite guests over the years who passed away recently, Pat Conroy. He could write a big, fat book, too.
Oh, yes, he could. Pat was a lot better at the descriptive part than I am. And, you know, I got to meet him shortly before his death. I didn't know he was ill, and we were in the same place. Were we in Charleston? Savannah, mm-hmm. Georgia. And I got to meet him. We were both doing book signings, and we got to the end of our lines. And, boy, he made me feel really good. I didn't think he'd know me from Adam, but he knew who I was, and we had a couple of phone calls where Pat called me, and he'd been into the drinks a little bit, and boy, that was some entertaining stuff. And he knew about the South, you know, I will say that. And I may not know much, but I know about the South too, so we felt some kinship there.
Yeah, he was a sweet, sweet gentleman.
Well, he was, but you know, he was feared up there for his letters to the editor. Pat could get pretty irate with people. He was he had that side to him.
He had strong opinions. Now, looking at Mississippi, I understand you have sort of a tenuous link to William Faulkner.
Yeah, I do. I do. You know, I went to Ole Miss, and Oxford's the home of Faulkner. And when I was living there, I sort of inherited from a Natchez guy the right to live in this little two-room, they call it a cabin. It was really sort of a house. But Faulkner, as a child, his Mammy Callie, they called her, lived there. A woman who was born a slave, who was sort of Faulkner's nanny and in the family, would tell the boys stories in that little house. And I remember when I moved in, 2 days after that, there was a freeze. And, Lord, my pipes broke and the thing flooded. And that place, I'm not into supernatural or anything, but I got to say, if anything ever felt a little haunted, it was that place.
What is it about Mississippi? One of my favorite writers was from Mississippi, and I wished I could have had him on my show, but he left us too early, a guy named Larry Brown.
Oh, yeah. Well, people always ask that, what is it about Mississippi? I mean, there's a lot of writers here, and I mean, you can go down a long list, and they joke and say, is it something in the water? My first literary agent, who was from Oregon, her explanation was great suffering produces great art. That was kind of a backhanded thing, but there's something to that. I mean, this is what I say, Vic. When I get off the interstate and I'm on tour, I travel, every place looks almost the same. It feels almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
I get it when a rock band says, "Hello, Cleveland," and they're really in a different city, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But let me tell you, when you're in Mississippi, you know you're somewhere, and you know where you are. There is nothing homogenized, sterile about it. You are in the home of the blues, the home of the Klan, the home of Faulkner and Tennessee Williams. You are in a place. You are in America, and America is still America there. And I'm not saying that's all a good thing. It's not. But since art and writing is about voice and perspective and point of view, it's one of the best places you could ever grow up.
Greg Iles joins us. We're talking about his Natchez Burning trilogy, and the final book just came out. It's called Mississippi Blood. Greg, after that terrible accident and you rethought this work, did you sit down then and while you were getting better, work on these books and write it all before you put out the first one?
No. You know what I had to do? I really even at that point thought it would just be two books. And so I went back into the first one and I saw where I had cheated myself of the truth and even protected myself. And I just started to deal in a raw, absolutely realistic way with the issues that were there, with the scenes that were there. And then it just grew as I went. And look, like I told you, I'd lost my publisher. So around the time of finishing the second, I had to submit it just like a new writer and find a new publisher. And then I had the bones of the third one about 2 years ago when I started this third volume. And I took a little extra time with it because a guy I just talked to said it's one of the best compliments I've gotten. He said, "You stuck the landing." I tell you, when you've already got people invested 1,600 pages in, there's a lot of pressure to get it right. And you gotta think about it a little bit.
Greg, you mentioned losing your publisher. I understand you also lost your dad.
Yep. And that was something. You know, my wreck was 2011. I lost him in 2010. I did get to have some talks with him about what I was going to do, and he supported it. He knew I was writing about him. Now, I will do a disclaimer. The sins of Tom Cage in this book aren't the sins of my father exactly, but certainly he knew it was going to be, had he lived, it would have been, let's say, some complex territory to navigate for him or to go across, not navigate. But I think it probably helped the book, but it certainly didn't help me. I mean, I had the thought this morning. I wish I'm going out on this tour, the realization of this series, and, man, I only wish he was here to see it because I tell you what, his life was books. He was a doctor, and his life was medicine. But beyond that, he spent his whole life, every penny he ever had, building up a library. If you ever go in his house, one of the first things you'll see is the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, which take shelf after shelf after shelf. And then beyond that, every subject in the world, but mostly the South and literature. So I miss him, obviously.
So the library didn't burn?
No, it did not. Unlike in The Quiet Game. Yeah, that boy. Now, he did live to see that scene, and that he did not like that at all, even the hint that could happen.
My guest is Greg Iles. Greg, he's a really complex character, Dr. Tom Cage, and we don't really know what's going to happen with him. You keep this story going with him. I thought in the first book that he was going to drop dead with a cigar in his mouth, and you just...
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, that in a way, that'd be a fitting ending, die in the saddle like that. But, you know, and I had no intent to sort of leave anything open-ended in this, but when I got to the end of the trial and realized what that needed to be, and I do think, if I say so myself, I think the present ending, you know, what you're trying for as a writer, you can't think about the fact that you have unlimited options because it can make you a little crazy, but what you want to arrive at is the ending that once you've written it seems inevitable and that it never could have been anything else. And I hope I've come to that ending. And that ending did leave, you're right, the door open for the very end of Tom's story. Now, I will not write that next, but maybe one or two books out, that will be the last one with this universe.
Greg, after all this time and all this anticipation for this final book in the series, you're just getting ready to go out on book tour. It's a massive tour. Authors rarely go on tours like this anymore. You're going to be out on the road for a month. You've got 29 cities, 29 dates going on. That must be exhausting. Are you looking at it with a mixed feeling of jubilation and dread?
You know what you feel? It's like when we used to see an actor on The Tonight Show, and they would be talking about the movie that had just come out. what you start to figure out as you got older was that actor was already making the next movie, and they were having to tour around talking about what they finished. Mm. That's sort of what this is like. I've spent 8 exhausting years producing a 2,000-page epic and about some very serious subject matter, and it's wiped me out. When I started this, I felt young, and at this point, I'm starting to feel old, and I'm writing the next book on the road. So it's sort of a schizophrenic feeling to go from store to store and show to show talking about something that, for me, I've moved past. But, of course, readers are just coming to it. So that's the difficulty of doing a tour like this.
You're actually able to write on the road? I'm impressed.
I'm not normally, but I really think I have to this time. This is one of my shorter books, and it's one of those things that, you know, strike while the iron's hot. That's a cliche, but there's a lot of truth in all the old cliches.
Can you talk about the project? Or
well, it's set. You know, we mentioned Ole Miss and Oxford. This book is actually set at Ole Miss in Oxford. It's a shorter book, similar to one of my books like 24 Hours, that's sort of, I call, a locked room thriller where you have very defined elements and a very confined timeline. And it's for people who remember film noir, you know, Double Indemnity and Postman Always Rings Twice. Uh-huh. It's in that vein, and it's dark, but in that sense, it's a lot of fun. And to revisit the place that I went to school and a place that's changed so much and has so much literary history, from Faulkner all the way up through Donna Tartt and John Grisham and many Larry Brown and all the writers in residence who've been there. So it's going to be a very rich story and fun, too, a little bit lighter than what I've been doing.
The locked room, that was a 1930s kind of device. Is someone murdered in a locked room in this one?
No, but you know what I do? I've used that locked room idea. I've used that locked room term to describe any thriller that you think of it like a Swiss watch. You know, it's in a confined structure, and it has a limited number of moving parts that have to fit together perfectly, and the mystery is there from the start and right in front of your eyes, you know. So I'm not being completely correct with the term, but that's still, for me, I use it as a designator.
Greg Iles has been talking to us about his Natchez Burning trilogy. It started with Natchez Burning and continuing with The Bone Tree, and now the third book, Mississippi Blood, has just come out, and he's going to be coming through on book tour. You can see him in Cincinnati. He'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. And he'll be coming through Dayton on Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m. And if you're going to be in Cincinnati the night before you're in Dayton at Books & Company, that might give you time to go over to a museum you like.
I was going to say, if people really want to see me, they need to go over to Wright-Patterson, and they'll see me wandering through the Aviation Museum looking at those airplanes, which I love to do when I come that way.
Okay, you just got a tip there. And, gosh, this is a huge tour. They're sending you everywhere. They must like you.
I don't know about that. I'll only know when I get to each place, you know?
And I see you're hitting some hot spots in Mississippi. You're starting off in Jackson, then going to Greenwood, Tupelo, Oxford, and what's it like?
See, think of what I was telling you about Mississippi. All right, I'm going to Greenwood, which is the Delta near the home of the blues. I'm going to Tupelo, which is the home of Elvis Presley, and I'm going to Oxford, which is William Faulkner. I mean, Mississippi is Americana through and through.
Well, speaking of Elvis and Memphis, when you're at the Air Force Museum, the Memphis Belle is being restored.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
So,
will I get to see that?
I'm not sure if you will or not, but they'll probably talk to you about it if you want.
Okay, cool. All right, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, this is quite an expedition going through these books, and as you mentioned, it would be fine, I suppose, to start with the third one, but I'm inclined to go back now and read all your stuff, Greg.
Well, I hope you do. And, you know, it's I tend to skip genres, and I move around a lot. I'm one of the few writers who's gotten to pursue whatever I'm most interested in at the time. You know, a lot of writers end up having to sort of rewrite the last book each time, and I've never done that. And so I won't say, you know, I'm not one of those guys who say you'll love every book I've done, because I've done so many different things. But I think maybe 8 times out of 10, I think you'll be glad you opened the cover.
Greg, I have time for just one more question.
Sure.
What's the best thing that ever happened to you?
Oh, my God. You know better than to ask a question like that.
Oh, you can't say it on the radio, huh?
Well, you couldn't even pick something like that.
She's sitting right there, right?
Yeah, well, you know, kids, too.
Okay.
But, as relates to writing, I'll say this, and that is when you realize you're actually going to be able to make a living writing books, that is, you realize what a privilege that is. You grow up your life finding new universes, new worlds in books, and you revere the writers that you read and love, and to get to do that for a living, you almost don't have a boss, and it's just, it's lucky. You feel lucky.
Greg, thanks for everything.
Thank you, Vic. I had a good time, man.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Greg Iles. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.